Senate Committee on Local Government and Urban Affairs will come to order. And the first thing we're going to consider is Senate Bill 423, Mr. Steele. You want to come on up and state your name and address for the record? Tell us what we ought to know about the bill.
Mr. Chairman, where should I sit?
Just sit right there.
Did Mr. Randall give you a list, a letter with several names from the...
That, was there a copy of that? Copies have to be made, should remember, so...
How do you wish me to proceed now?
I gather there's some need for this bill. We got to have that short list, so we have to read it.
Senator, actually, there's a great need for this bill. I'm here, I'm a resident of Langill Valley in Klamath County, and believe me, we really have a mosquito problem in the Langill Valley. In fact, if it gets any worse, I think most of the farmers and ranchers will need to carry quarter-mile bloodmobiles around with them when they irrigate. But one of the reasons for requesting the passage of this bill to increase the amount of millage that we can assess is the fact that we have approximately 175,000 or 180,000 acres in the Langill Valley District. But we only have an assessed value, I believe it's 13 million, 13,118,030.
That gives you how much?
Well, we take in approximately $4,200 or $4,800 a year. It costs us somewhere around $2,100 to $2,200 to apply one application.
And how do you apply it?
Well, they apply it by ear. And one of the problems is that we can't use the old insecticides that basically had some punch and residual effects. And one of the new applications with the new phosphates will only last approximately 2 weeks. And so it's necessary to make more applications during the year, and there just are insufficient funds to do so.
The mosquitoes affect the livestock?
Yes, they do. In fact, I've been told in parks of the Langill Valley, the livestock huddle together so that they can protect each other with their tails. It's pretty thick, Senator. And it is a problem, and most of the ranchers, we have some distinguished ranchers here today. Lewis Randall, he's a major landowner in Langill Valley, and Guy Hitson is here. He's on the board of directors of the Langill Valley Vector Control District. Mr. Hal Balin is here. He's a major landowner. I would like to submit to you a letter which Mr. Balin wrote to the committee, actually, which sets forth his position quite thoroughly. And we have Ray Hall, he's the chairman, I believe, of the Vector Control Board in Chiloquin, which has a similar problem that we do because of its size. So actually, there is a great need for the additional funds, and the people in Langill Valley would certainly appreciate this bill being passed.
How long has that district been in existence?
How long has it? 2 years?
2 years. It's a relatively new district.
Okay, you got any questions there?
There, well, I don't know the geography of the area very well. There wouldn't be any advantage of some of these districts combining.
Well, this has been talked about, Senator.
But even if that's just so, you probably you feel that you still need this legislation.
Yeah, it would be, yes, I think we would.
Chairman, when we get a quorum, I'm going to make a motion to pass it out. I think this is permissive legislation. I think it's all right.
We would certainly appreciate it. Would.
Thank you. Gentleman back there, Greg.
Yes, Mr. Hall. Your Honor, I was not really.
Tell us your name, will you?
Guy Hitson with the Langill Valley Vector District.
Sit down a second. Are these districts contiguous, or are there the long distances in between the different veterans' quarters?
Big county, and there is a long distance, but I know that we tried one time for Klamath County vector control, because I know it's a lot more economical, a lot more feasible, really. But the people in town already had it where our votes was at. They already had vector district. They didn't think that we needed vector district, see. So people either going to move or do something about this mosquito problem. And so we formed the Langell Valley. Chiloquin is forming one. Bly's in the making of forming one. And it one day will come to emerge into a Klamath a countywide, with people moving in like we have them moving in Klamath County into a countywide. And I think that myself personally the way it ought to be, but I suppose we can't do anything about that now because that has to be voted in. But there is a possibility, I think, really. We have a little district, we have a cemetery board, we have a park board, we have a vector control district, we have attorneys for each one of these things, and it gets to be a little ridiculous, really.
We had a bill we're considering in the, I guess, an elections committee, where they set the time for all special districts to have their elections at the same time, and a lot of times these districts, different types of districts, overlap to an extent sometimes. Also, they usually have the same attorney, and they find that the work he does for one district he can do for all at the same time, same election, would be less expensive for these districts.
This was Harry Boyven's idea exactly, is that maybe that the attorney could do all this work for, like we'd say, we even say we don't have a district, but we do have a park district, we do have a fire district, we do have all these others, and the attorney, we could combine it all, and then you could afford the attorney. See, it really are. If we paid an attorney, we wouldn't have nothing for mosquitoes. So there wouldn't be. it's at the present rate.
All right, thank you. Did you have a question, Ken? Thank you very much. I would gather that there's a reasonably good chance that when we get a quorum, I get this bill out of here and set the floor with a due pass recommendation. If anybody else feels compelled to testify on 423, you're welcome. You're in pretty good shape the way it is, however.
I have a copy of the written testimony I'd like to.
Thank you very much. Fred Hurd, right across the hall from me, won't leave me alone. We do get it out of committee. So. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your courtesy.
Appreciate you coming up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is William Musa, City Attorney of Salem, and I'm here today representing the Local Government Committee of the State Bar on behalf of House Bill 2177. It's a very simple bill which repeals ORS 221-430 and 221-440, and I've circulated a prepared statement by our committee explaining the purpose of the repeal of these two sections. It's basically, as the summary indicates, it's a the sections deal with giving cities between 9,000 and 10,500 the power to levy license and revenue and sales tax. Our committee feels that these two sections of the state law are not necessary. The history of the bill is included in our statement. Apparently it was originally passed for the city of Astoria. The city of Astoria has never used it to our knowledge, and there's only about I think, two or three cities in the state in that classification. Basically, we feel the cities already have the power or the power available to them through their charter or amendments to the charter, and it was felt that this sort of cleansing of the sections on the state bar relative to the cities.
Well, they had that power at the time this was also passed.
That's true. That's true. Except that in the 1930s, there weren't as many court decisions interpreting the powers of the cities to tax as there are now. But really, the reason that this was brought to our attention was a case over in Seaside, which we cite, where the plaintiff, I believe in that case, brought up the point that, well, if it's in the state law, you must need statutory authority to levy tax, and this is not necessarily so.
Did you have a question, Ken? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Everett St.
Style.
Okay, I didn't see the I in there.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Everett.
This is on 2223.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Everett Stiles, and I reside at 2730.
One second. sorry.
My name is Everett Stiles, and I reside at 2730 Holiday Drive South in Salem, and I'm the Assistant Executive Secretary of the Oregon State Employees Association, and am representing that group today. Hospital 2223 would require public employers to post notice informing public employees of their status in regards to political activities. When the 1967 session of the Oregon legislature removed most of the political prohibitions on public employees, they went in the direction of allowing public employees access and freedom in their political activities. However, since that time, not too many public employees have become actively involved in politics, particularly state employees, the people that we represent. I think this has primarily happened, or the lack of activity has taken place as a result of a lack of knowledge as to what rights public employees had. What rights did they have in the area of political involvement? What right did they have in running for the legislature or for political office? We see House Bill 2223 as a vehicle which would at least give an expression by the public employer of a public employee's rights, also would indicate to them what they can and what they cannot do. OSEA has, over the past 2 years, has intensified its campaign in political education, and I have brought with me for distribution today some copies of political education guide that has been developed by our organization in an attempt to educate our members and the employees of the state of Oregon as to what political rights they actually have. However, as I've said, we haven't gotten to all of these employees, and there is still a lot of apprehension as to what an employee can and cannot do. I think a very good example, and I would only cite this as an example, not to embarrass any individual, but in the 1971 campaigns, there was a question posed to our office, and it was posed by a state employee. This employee called and asked if it would be legal for him to put a political campaign sign, just a notice, in his front yard. And we indicated our answer to this and then suggested that he should have been able to have gotten the information from his administrator of his office. We felt that this was particularly the case when we found out who the administrator was. The administrator of his office was the former head of the Civil Service Commission of the state of Oregon. And yet this individual was not appraised as to what rights the public employees had within the state of Oregon. We think this is one step further in educating the employees in Oregon and calling to their attention what rights they do have and what prohibitions that will be imposed upon them in political activities. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Senator? Thank you very much.
I don't know how much has already been covered, but I would like to draw your attention to several parts of the bill, which I think could stand a little change. One is in line 22 through 23, which could be amended to read, "Nothing in the law is intended to restrict the right of a public employee to express his personal political views."
What line is that, buddy?
Line 22 through 23.
And how would you, what you're
suggesting? "Nothing in the law is intended to restrict the right of a public employee to express his personal political views." The reason I'm suggesting that is that several people drew my attention to that line and suggested that the language might be changed to prevent misunderstanding. And I'm simply suggesting that if that's what the committee feels too, that's one way to change it. No, I don't think it does either. Merely changes the section, basically, to law. And the second amendment would be on line 32, where it would, the change would be adding an A after subsection 1, and I think it is supposed to be after subsection 1, on line 33, delete or 2 and insert 2 or 3. And this amendment would simply extend the penalty of misdemeanor to section 3 as well as 1 and 2, and that was the original form of the bill. This would make this law a law related to the posting of employee political rights the same as the laws governing posting of workman's comp.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jurgensen.
This sign is posted in the state capitol. Who would be responsible for the governor?
Well, I would assume that there's a clear line of responsibility in agencies, and it will vary from agency to agency. I wouldn't presume to delineate in each agency, but I would assume that if, well, I think that first person that would be responsible would be the head of an agency, but that if he would not be held ultimately responsible for someone further on down the line who refused to post it, the same as in, for example, the welfare department. If in one particular office, the department head did not post this, even though he was told he should do so, and it was clear, you wouldn't call in someone like Andrew Juris on it. The reason I was even suggesting this penalty is that if you have a law that requires that something be done and you have no consequences whatsoever for it not being done, then the chances are that if it's a change from the past as far as expectations are concerned, you're not going to have as many people very anxious to comply with it.
My only concern is I don't know where the buck stops this thing covered employees.
I imagine it would be the same as where the buck stops as far as posting workman's comp laws. I think it's a good point. I'm just saying that I think that's already taken care of under the present law regarding something like workman's comp.
There's another employer in the state, in the geography of Oregon, as big as the state of Oregon as far as employer goes. And I see what you're getting at, but I think also the problem attacking a misdemeanor on your own.
Well, I think that I'd only be able to appeal to the experience that we've had with the workman's comp law and see whether or not there's been a problem in enforcing that.
Wendy, I have two questions, and I apologize for the permission just for your testimony. You don't care whether it's typewritten, printed, or whatever the bill says in a typewritten form.
Well, I think a typewritten would make it basically, what I was trying to get at was printed rather than, you know, just a written notice.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because for instance, on the
Mm-hmm.
The other question, would you have any objection if it were downgraded to a violation as opposed to misdemeanor? Misdemeanor has a jail sentence, it is a crime, or the violation carries, in effect, a civil penalty, still an offense, still carries a criminal code, but it's, you're not arrested as such, and you're not, you don't have to put on your employment application that you've been arrested as a crime.
No, I would have no objection to that. I just feel that there has to be some consequences for failing to conform the law.
Also, as it is there now, there'd be no penalty anyway, because it's an unclassified misdemeanor. It has to be what the penalty is there, or else there's no penalty anyway. The violation, I don't know, is there a limitation on what the fine can be of a violation like that?
No, I think we'd have to prescribe a violation.
Violation if it is so designated in the statute, defines an offense, or is the offense is punishable only by a fine, forfeiture, fine, forfeiture, or civil penalty. All right. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else testify on 2223? And was there anybody else testify on 2177? And on 508, while I'm going to stay on 24 on the way it
was.
Now we got four.
He's coming, I'm going.
Okay, let's go to our favorite bill, SB 159. You've got in front of you something that you learned. You all received, I gather you all received copies of amendments that were proposed by the Oregon Association of Realtors, Sam Church, several pages of amendments, eight to be exact. And yesterday, Mr. Church of the Oregon Association of Realtors, Mr. Vanata of the AOI, Mr. George Burney of some landlord organization, what it is, and Mr. Williamson, Legal Aid, met. Discuss Mr. Church's amendment, and you have before you a five-page document with Mr. Williamson's type name, the date of March 29, 1973, in the upper right-hand corner before you. In reading that, I gathered that there were some agreements. Some of these amendments provided by Mr. Church, but the bulk of them, there was no agreement. Is that correct, Charlie?
The last two pages of those indicate the things that just could not be agreed.
stand, get up here, and let's go to the ones that you do agree upon and see what the committee's meeting is about those. What we had finally, and what your hand engrossed copy should read as follows, and I'm not sure that it does. Agrees to the exculpation, I got an extra syllable there, sorry, or limitation of any liability of landlord arising as a result of the landlord's negligence. And the rest of it stricken out. That was what the.
That's what it was, yeah.
That's, yeah.
But they're offering it.
Okay, that's right. That's what we're working from is that language.
Yeah, right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I suppose this is going to be rolled and gross.
Oh, yes.
All right.
Have you got that hand engrossed copy?
Yep.
Yeah. The reason I raised about that particular line was that initially we hadn't crossed out the end of line 23 and all of line 24, which was the intent of the committee, and that's the way it should be now. Okay, now, what's the effect of this proposed section, subsection C?
It puts this conduct, in my opinion, it puts this conduct on both parties. And willful misconduct and negligence. In the amended bill, the entire onus is on the landlord. This puts it on either party. Or the other party's willful misconduct.
Actually, Stan, I don't think it does that.
Well,
speak up, Charlie.
I don't think it does that. I think it. I didn't realize that was the purpose of his amendment, but it does, subsection one above on page seven just says that the tenant may not provide that the tenant. And then his language says agrees to the exculpation of liability of the other party.
Well, does it do any more than this? It makes it a two-edged sword rather than a single-edged sword, and he adds willful misconduct as well as negligence. Does it do anything more than that?
I don't think it makes it a two-edged sword. That's
what I agree to the amendment, but it doesn't make it a two-edged sword. But that's because of subsection 1, the first part on line 16.
The rent agreement may not provide that the tenant, okay. All right, we got the explanation of that. Now let's go down to section 12. Oh, yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like, before we move it out, to expand the opportunity. I don't think it does that, Stan. I think that if you want to make it go both ways, you're going to do as Charlie said.
I'm not going to make a big deal out of it, Senator Carson.
All right. Move on, Mr. Chairman.
Pardon?
That's fine. No.
All right. Section 12, page 8. John, what we have here is certain amendments that Mr. Church proposed. We received, I don't know if you saw them or not, there's several pages of amendments. We got the day after our last hearing, and he and Charlie Williamson and Fred Banana and Jordan Burney sat down and agreed to certain amendments. That's what we're going over now. Okay. On section 12 on security deposits, what's the effect of this change?
Mr. Chairman, I think we all agreed that this was probably the most troublesome area, the whole bill. The one most needing some remedial legislation. Essentially, we have adopted the amendments that were suggested by my organization. We cut out one section of it, which would be subsection C. Now, first of all, in our amendments on 4A, we cut out the words...
Are you referring to what? The amendments you submitted or what's on...
Gosh, I don't know. I'm so confused over all the amendments we got.
Well, here's what we're working on, so we all talk on the same thing.
All right, let's use Charlie.
Stan, just a minute. We've got this hand and growth bill. You got a copy of that?
Yeah.
All right. That's what we're working from. Then the other thing we're working from is this thing that's got Charlie Williams' name up in the right, upper right-hand corner that says March 29.
Yeah.
Now that's what we're working from. You work from anything else, but let us know.
All right. Well,
Now we're down on section 12. There's section the bottom 12. Of the first page of that stuff that Charlie gave us.
We deleted C there, did we not?
Yes.
There was a clause in the suggested amendments to clean the premise, that added C to subsection 4, to clean the premises upon termination of the tenancy, and we all agreed that that should go out.
Well, that wasn't in the first place, was it?
No. That this should, that a cleaning deposit should be an entirely separate and distinct deal. That would be between the landlord and the tenant. Wasn't that the general feeling of it, Charlie?
Yes. Briefly, what the amendment does is spell out more clearly what a security deposit does, what it can be used for. The main thing that I think the amendment does is delete the ceiling on security deposits, which the bill, existing bill, has of 1 month's periodic rent, which they wanted to delete, and which, as far as legal aid is concerned, our clients generally don't give more than 1 month now anyway. But
didn't they distinguish here between a month's rent and a security deposit? We're not talking about the same thing. When we're talking about in section 12 in the hand and growth bill, 12.1, that's not talking about, for instance, the last month's rent. That's talking about a security deposit in excess of the amount of 1 month's rent. That could be over and above the last month's rent. Is that correct?
No, yeah. That's not my understanding, Senator. Whereas the last month's rent would be security for payment of the last month's rent, so if they pay last month's rent, that would be covered.
That normally occurs only in a written lease. It doesn't occur in most month-to-month tenancies. There's no extra month's rent.
Well, actually, you have situations where you do give the last month's rent, and you have a lease. In addition to that, you do give a security deposit.
Yeah, well, that's in... let's say a big high-rise, but the average mom-and-pop operation, there is no first and last month's rent. You pay the first month's rent in advance.
I think briefly, the amended hand and gross bill would prohibit a landlord from taking the last month's rent and anything in addition. He could take the last month's rent. The amendments would allow him to take more than 1 month's rent, more than the last month's rent as security.
All right.
What's the meaning of it?
Why?
Well, it was to set a limit so that everybody understood what could be, how much, what's the limit.
Well, what's wrong with 1 month's rent?
As a practical matter, there's nothing wrong with 1 month as far as I'm concerned.
As far as I'm
concerned. Nothing wrong. It doesn't matter. Either section is fine with me.
Doesn't matter to me.
I don't know what. It doesn't matter to anybody why we're even trying to change the bill. I don't understand.
Wait a minute. There's a lot of meetings for it.
aside the fact that you don't disagree on 1 month's rent, are there other things that you feel are desirable in here?
A couple other minor changes in subsection 4 of 12.
Let's stick with section 12 for a minute.
Yeah, section 12. In sub 4A, a suggested amendment was called for to remedy the tenant's default in the payment of rent. We agreed that that should be deleted and insert in the performance of the rental agreement. In other words, instead of calling for a payment of rent for...
That's what Charlie's got there in his stuff, from the second
yes,
page.
Yes, we agreed on that.
Let me ask you something, Charlie. Was it felt that by spelling this out, there would be less or fewer disputes between the landlord and the tenant as to what the rights were with respect to the security deposit?
I frankly don't think there's any substantive difference between the amendments and the existing bill, except for the limitation on the amount of the rent, the amount of security that could be taken. But if they want the amended bill, I said I didn't care, because I don't think it's going to make a difference one way or the other.
Okay.
All right, Don. And
just a minute now. Does anybody else have any questions on section 12? Well, that ends what you agreed upon, right?
Yeah.
So from now on, we got just what you disagreed upon.
No.
There's one more change in subsection 5. The words are added within 30 days of the termination.
Subsection 5 of what section?
Of 12. We're still on 12. Within 30 days after the termination of the tenancy is added, and notice is changed to the county.
See, I think they want to know the difference between the amended bill and this.
New language.
Well, I can see that.
We felt that this spelled it out a little better. Within 30 days. Now, many times a landlord can't tell what damages have been sustained by a property, either in cleaning damages, so on. This gives him 30 days to determine his damages and to give the tenant a written accounting. Now, that's not spelled out quite so clearly in the Uniform Act or the amended bill.
Charlie, on the remainder of these proposed amendments on page 2 and 3, do you have any quarrel with those? Or are these all agreed upon?
These I think we can agree upon.
Do they change the bill?
They do. There's some substantive changes there that do change the bill.
On 10B?
Well, the first one deletes what floors, walls, and ceilings which are structurally sound. We took out structurally sound, but kept in must be maintained in good repair. So I
shouldn't that be Charlie, which are structurally sound and removed. Shouldn't the and go out of
the yes. Yes.
So are you taking out
and as well.
Which are structurally sound and
maintain a good repair.
They
don't have to be structurally sound.
Well, Mr. Burney indicated that maintain a good repair meant structurally sound, and structurally sound might be subject to some.
It's spelled out in here in the previous language. He's got to keep the place electrically. He's got to provide an adequate furnace. And this, that, and the other thing. These are spelled out. Well, structurally sound, we felt, were covered already in the rules.
On page 10C, the deletion of D is a substantive change. I don't know if you want to make it. 10C, sub D would be deleted.
Sure.
You have no objection, Charlie?
I just, they felt very strongly about that, and I, that's something that we would be willing to give up if the committee so agrees.
Structurally, that's a pretty unwieldy section, right?
This 10C?
No, section 14. That's what we're talking about, isn't it, on page?
Yes.
Well, maybe it wouldn't be so bad if it was just five.
It's basically taken out of the landlord's house bill. It's based on the California law.
This is the California Civil Code, section 1941. With the exception of J, which is not in the California code. If that's deleted.
If that's deleted.
There are some safeguards earlier in that section, though, that it has to be, their agreement would have to be made in good faith, not for avoiding the...
The agreement must be substantiated by consideration.
If it's passed the way it is, only the landlord could perform the repairs to put it into compliance, right?
John, I think what the thought here, at least what I had when that first came in, was that it would let a tenant occupy a premise that substantially failed to comply with applicability housing code materially affecting health and safety while he's working on it. He could be in there years of working on it. So that's why I thought this language was important.
Senator Burns, I don't think this would apply to a high-rise south of the auditorium where they have a maintenance man. But you got a rental out in Wagon Tire, then you're going
to... They don't have any rentals in Wagon Tire.
Yes, they do. They have a motel there. Maybe it's a perfect...
I'm thinking more of those rentals in those old houses that are on the same street where I live, Sam.
And certainly the parties, if they so desire, should be able to get together and agree on repairs. And maybe the landlord merely furnished the material, maybe they make a deal for half a month's rent or a week's rent, or maybe it's a cash payment. But whatever their deal is, it should be able to be made. But again, clearly stated, and some consideration for it. I'll do this for you if you do that for me.
Well, it's pretty wordy. I don't know.
The next amendment, the next two amendments simply clean up the abandonment of personal property section that I...
Do you feel any of the rest of these here on page 3 are of any substantial change?
No. The clean up the retaliatory eviction section slightly, and I think that's, they're fine.
Okay, now, on page 7, line 25, starting with those proposed amendments which they do not agree.
Page what?
Page 7 of the handbook.
So you know the Washington Senate passed a that one.
Do
you know what it was?
Yeah, I have a copy. Pretty good bill. It was based on the Uniform Act, with, and they amended it as well. Yeah. Quite different from this one, and it's different from the uniform one.
Have you seen the bill?
Yes, I do. I have a copy if you want.
I'd like to see a copy.
So would I, Mr. Chairman. Maybe Charlie could allow us to borrow it.
I don't know if I have it with me.
Well, okay, we don't need it right now. All right. On page 7, line 25, Mr. Church proposed that. Starting at line 25, all of 2 through line 29 be stricken.
Well, we came to a disagreement on this as to what it meant. Mr. Williamson feels that. Well, express your opposition to it. You did it better than I could.
This isn't a major sticking point, but in other parts of the country where tenants do have some rights, it appears that landlords write leases that say the tenant has no rights, and attempts to enforce those. And if there's no penalty against the landlord from doing that, he's liable to just do it. And if a tenant stands up for his rights, he could enforce them. And that agreement would be unenforceable, but many tenants look at the whatever he's got there, whatever contract he has, and says, well, if it's in there, I must be bound by it, and back out. It's not a major sticking point. If
I kind of like that.
Okay. Any questions on that? Right, let's go down to the next one. On page 10B.
As I stated a moment ago, the language that is agreed on up to this point is the California Civil Code, Section 1941, which has been in effect in California for a number of years, and reports from that state indicate there's no particular problem. Our objection to this is that essentially, again, the law is being used as an enforcer of codes. And this is the function of city and county government. And in fact, what you're saying here, if you adopt this language, is the landlord has got to say that this meets the health, this meets the fire code. Well, you've already said that he's got to provide a safe and sanitary place, adequate heating, adequate wiring. So what if you get a tenant during cold weather that puts 6 heaters into the electric wiring and burns the house down, like happened in North Portland last winter during the cold spell? Now, this cannot be the landlord's responsibility, and we don't feel that this law should be a matter of code. The tenant can always go over to the nearest fire hall and scream to the fire marshal if he thinks the place does not meet the code. Or the tenant and the landlord can remove all the debris. He's got to remove the debris at the time he starts the tenancy. But the tenant, on the other hand, can throw paper up against the furnace, and pretty soon you've got a fire hazard.
I inserted that as Senator John Burns indicated that he felt something about fire should be in there for habitability.
Are there any questions on that? John, the proposed language is safety from the hazards of fire, distinguished from the present language, compliance with provisions of applicable fire code materially affecting health and safety.
I think he's, Chairman, if I may object, it seems to me that this is already in there. It says that he's got to provide an adequate heating system, he's got to provide adequate wiring, he's got to remove debris and filth and this, that, and the other thing. And to me, he, under the rules that we've already set up, he's got to provide a place that's free from fire hazard.
Well, apparently.
If he does, then what difference does it make?
Did you find it on page 10B?
I see it, but I don't see the proposed amendment in his handout.
No, it's in this thing that Charlie Williams gave us. Deborah, right
hand. I suggested putting in safety, a reasonable safety from the hazards of fire, but
page 4 of that.
They didn't want that. I proposed that, but they didn't want anything in there about
it.
We think it's already protected.
Yeah, I'm changing the problem there.
What did you say, John?
I think it's probably there. Take it out, please. No, leave it in the way it is. You can buy everything. I don't even know why you have to say materially affecting health and safety, because five of the provisions of the applicable fire code.
John, the reason we put that in there, and we did it in several places, was because of technical violations of codes, and we thought it should be related to actually health and safety, and that's why we put in materially affecting health and safety, so we're just talking about technical violations.
Okay.
And we did it in several places throughout the...
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the alternate language that Charlie suggested, with alternate language that I understand Mr. Church doesn't agree with. The substitute for the J that appears in the markup.
All right. It's been moved that the language for J in page 10B be changed to read safety from the hazards of fire. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed? Okay, that's adopted. All right, now on page 14, line 9, self-help for minor defects. This is a major hang-up. The landlords don't want anything in there. Tenants feel represented as be rather strong as it should be. Does anybody want to make a motion on that?
Mr. Chairman, can I prevail upon Mr. Church to hit me again with why they want that out of there, briefly?
Well, in this area, I'm not only speaking for my clients, but I'm speaking for Mr. Vanatta and Mr. Burney. Now, we spent 3.5 hours going over this amended bill yesterday, discussing these very amendments for you this morning. We got this area, we just decided there was no use talking about it. I mean, we're so far apart on it that there was even no conversation. There was no point in starting on it. Because all we do is end up with the disagreement. What we're talking about here is that you're singling out one segment of business for special penalties. Now, we've got people in the grocery business, we've got people in the service station business, we have people in the rental business, and they're providing a service, they're providing housing. Now, you're saying here that their customers, they don't like the service, all right, they don't have to pay for it. And it might be like a grocery store where they say, well, the groceries are defective, therefore I'm not going to pay for it until you make them good. And what you're actually doing here is interrupting the cash flow. Anytime you're taking money out of the rental, which is the only item that the guy has, you're taking that out, then you're getting to the position where you're interfering actually with his business. Now, the tenant can still, under the provisions of this bill, can still appeal to building inspectors. He can still appeal to the code enforcers under some other sections. But we don't think there's any justification for anyone to be able to spend the landlord's money and then withhold rent. And every place where it's ever been tried, you've got financial disaster, and you're drying up the housing market. If you want to go back to New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, some of those other areas, you drive down streets miles on miles on miles, where this is part of the problem, rent withholding. And I pointed out the situation in St. Louis, where the St. Louis Housing Authority blasted down a $75 million operation because the tenants withheld rent.
What was the name of that?
Glad to submit it to the committee's consideration.
What's the name of the housing project?
Through it I go. In St. Louis.
Did you read they tore it down with what?
They blasted it down.
Why?
The rent payments never covered the project's full operating costs. Indeed, it was planned that subsidies from the city and other sources would make up the difference. But the subsidies never reached their expected levels. The Housing Authority began to make maintenance budget reductions.
This was a public housing project?
Right. In retaliation...
This bill doesn't affect public housing projects, does it?
There's no exemption in it yet for public housing.
Are you representing the public housing project?
Well, I haven't seen any has there been an adopted exemption? Well, the point I'm making, it doesn't make a difference whether you're talking about a $2,000 house or a $75 million...
Does it have anything to do with the tenants withholding the rent?
Yes, they withheld the rent. In retaliation, some residents withheld rent payments.
I think that project there went down in the history of America as being the worst project ever been constructed.
Well...
And that's why they tore it down.
I'll be glad to give it to you, Mr. Chairman.
Fine.
Read it.
And we got a book on it, too.
Yeah.
And we'll put that in alongside that article.
Well, go up and down the streets of New York, Philadelphia. There's supposed to have been 40,000 units withdrawn from the rental market in New York within the last year. We just can't buy this amendment, and I speak for all three of us at this point.
All right. Is there any motion with respect to Section 20?
Well, I'll move we delete it.
Discussion. That's what they call self-help, part of the tenant.
Or rent reduction or whatever. Interruption of cash flow.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the amendment, the amendment, the motion is to strike Section 20. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? No. Did you vote, Senator Burns? I vote no. Motion made.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to leave.
Okay.
And we still have a quorum. But before I leave, I'd like to move. I'd like to make a motion on that vector control.
Okay, let's do that. All right. We've got a couple of bills that are virtually
controversial. Yes, require a four vote majority to pass the amendment?
No. That's my understanding. Four
I move SB 423 to the floor.
423, what is it?
423.
Can I find it with the feathers? Yeah, there it is.
That's the vector control of the case.
Climate
right. They came up with numbers.
Oh, it got here.
Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll. Well, I, the only thing, if you were here, the testimony on this municipal taxation thing, this is a law that, that was enacted years ago where they didn't, weren't sure that cities had the authority to pass a sales tax. It was adopted in 1933. Now it's clear that they do. They want to have one, and this just takes down the statute recommendation of the Oregon State Bar. I hear a motion to pass the clause, do pass recommendation. Senator John Byrne, any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Carson?
Aye.
Senator Meeker? Senator John Byrne?
Aye.
Senator Spencer?
Aye. Thank you.
What number was that?
That's 2177, Senator Carson, carry that. You got it. They have the state's here. All right.
Mr. Chairman?
No.
Is there going to be a reconsideration of time away?
No, that, we're going to leave the way it is. Leave the way it is. Gentlemen, I'm going to be impossible to finish up 159 today. So we'll start the next time, and I don't know how we're going to do it unless we have a special meeting on it. How about an 8 o'clock Monday morning meeting, 159, try to get it done. 1 hour meeting. Can you make it, Ken?
Yep.
I have one at 8:30. Oh, you're on committee? Well, could you make it happen? Senator Carson, Senator Meeker, pardon me, could you make it 8 o'clock Monday morning?
Yes.
And we can notify Senator Howard. We'll do that 1 hour Monday morning, 8 o'clock, okay, sorry.
8 o'clock Monday morning?
Yeah.
Same room upstairs?
Chairman, I want.
407B.
I just want to take a moment to tell
A.
both Charlie and Stan, I very much appreciate, particularly Charlie, and I'm Stan too, but particularly Charlie worked very hard with this, and very cooperative, and I appreciate it.
I was going to do that, but we got another way to floor.
Well, I'm going to do it several times again.